Our next case is number 242089, MCOM IT versus City of Bank of Florida. Okay, Mr. Ramey.
Yes, sir. Bill Ramey for the plaintiff, MCOM IP LLC. If it pleases the court, may I begin? Your Honor, this case was dismissed not because the complaint failed to give notice, but because the district court required proof. It required proof of both infringement and validity at the pleading stage. This is not Rule 8 what it requires. It's not what this court's case law requires. As under Twombly, Iqbal, Bod 8, and Dis Disease, this complaint was more than sufficient. The dismissal and the sanctions that followed cannot stand on the record before this court.
I'd like to focus for a minute at least on the validity piece of it. So it seems to me the district court quite plainly, I would say, did hold Claim 17 as well as the other three claims that are no longer, that you're not pressing here on appeal, to be invalid. It did so not on the 101 ground, which was separately placed before the court in the defendant's motion to dismiss, but rather on obviousness, on the ground that these four claims were not patentably distinct from what had already been held unpatentable by the board. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, that your only argument about validity in the blue brief is that the district court did not hold Claim 17 invalid. You don't otherwise say, if it did, here's why it was wrong.
We did, in fact, say that the standard for holding a claim invalid was clear and convincing.
I'm confessed. I'm a little confused.
Yes, sir.
Was there any briefing on obviousness, or did that arise only in connection with the attorney's fees?
That, in my belief, arrived only in connection with the attorney's fees. It wasn't clear to us that there was a proper validity challenge to the...
Their motion to dismiss has 6 or 7 pages on 103, why these claims are not patentably distinct from the claims held, canceled in the IPR.
Right, and that becomes a clear and convincing standard. That's evidentiary, whether, you know...
Judge Dyke asked if this came up only in attorney's fees or in the 12B6 motion.
It was
part of the 12B6 motion.
Yes, sir. Pardon me. I misunderstood the question.
He didn't rule in the 12B6 motion on obviousness, right?
Your Honor, that was somewhat confusing to me. What he held is not direct to patentable subject matter. He held in his order on the 12B6.
Right, and he was using that phrase, which we tend to use a variant of it in talking about 101, about eligible subject matter, but that phrase was used throughout the 6 or 7 pages of the 103 discussion in the motion to dismiss to refer specifically to obviousness. That is, the subject matter of the claims are not patentable because they are obvious. The reason they're obvious is that they're not patentably distinct from the subject matter of the claims canceled.
Yes, Your Honor. We would say that that's a factual question. If you get into what's obvious or not, that's a factual question.
I'm sorry. I'm still confused. I understand that there was briefing on the obviousness question, but I didn't understand, maybe I'm wrong about this, that the district court on the 12B6 motion on the merits rendered an obviousness decision. I saw him only as addressing the obviousness question in connection with attorney's fees. Am I mistaken about that?
I think the court did on the 12B6 say that the claims weren't addressed to patentable subject matter, but it didn't do it. Hard for me to tell whether it was a declaration of invalidity, and that what it found is it found that the pleading was not sufficient, and it dismissed the pleading on 12B6. So that there wasn't, in our mind, that wasn't a challenging the validity to the patent. That's why we briefed it as we did. However, in the motion for attorney's fees, the report and recommendation did go into that and say that the invalidation at the PTAB of the other independent claims is what made the case exceptional. And we think that, that was a core misunderstanding of the district court. The sanctions under the report and recommendation, and I'll focus on the report and recommendation mainly because Judge Scola actually adopted the report and recommendation in its entirety. So that's where I think the majority we can do, but there wasn't anything we would say there was anything exceptional in this case that we had a pleading.
Could I understand? Is there any argument that's any different between this case and the previous case insofar as we're talking about the adequacy of the pleading for infringement? Or is it, because we're talking now about attorney's fees. Is that the only,
Your Honor, we
different between the two cases?
We think that we think all of our cases we approach to provide the best claim charts that we can. So of course.
But answer my question. I mean, we started talking about attorney's fees. Insofar as the pleading of infringement is concerned, is this case the same as the previous case?
Different facts for different reasonable inferences we try to draw, but yes. But the big difference is that there's the sanctions bolted onto the end that we think were improper. But if we go down to the pleading standard, here we did tie into more of a common point of control, tried to give more detail, which we always try to do because we had more available from City National's website.
Wait, where is that?
Yes, Your Honor. And so if you go, that starts on appendix page 308, and actually it starts on page 306, Your Honor, but we talk about the preamble on 308 explaining how the unified banking system of City National works. And then we continue on through providing examples of what these different terms might mean to one of ordinary skill in the art and then examples from the patent of what we're referring to specifically allege. We always are trying to improve our claim charts for across cases. But if you get down to the common point of control for claim 17, after taking in the building of the unified banking platform from appendix 304 down to Appendix 327.
Just on the claim 17, common control point. That's page 329.
328 and 329, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Right. And in what way do you think that is more concrete or whatever the right term is than the counterpart pages as to HSBC?
Well, because we contend that the system of City National provides a common point of control. If we didn't do it before, and I think maybe the court might have indicated that we didn't make the allegation that there was a common point of control, and with reference to Claim 17, here specifically at appendix page 329, Your Honor, we do right up there in the explanation to the down below the claim element. The claim element's up top, and then right below there, we explain a common point of functionality. And then we explain how we define that and where we get that from. And then we provide examples from the URLs from City National's direct banking. So that we do provide this detail here. So we specifically allege common point of control in this one. And then, again, we provided appendix 331, Judge Albright's opinion to show the court, you know, to provide what some other courts had ruled on these claims about the common point of control. But here we go back to, if we go to switch briefly to the sanctions issues, I think are very important for this case. The report and recommendation actually relied solely on the dismissal under 12b-6 as a supporting exceptionality, the PTAB invalidation of other claims, and generalized litigation history. But it didn't actually perform any analysis on the actual strength of Claim 17 or litigation conduct in this case. So we would say that Octane Fitness is a totality of the circumstances, but the totality of the circumstances in this case, and we'd suggest that the R&R was too generalized, that it didn't provide that sufficient evidence for this court's appropriate appellate review. We'd ask for the court to reverse on that ground alone. Losing on a motion to desist doesn't automatically make a case exceptional, but that's what the R&R treated it as. Otherwise, every dismissed patent case would be automatically exceptional under 285. The R&A specifically actually states that one of the reasons for exceptional is we failed to satisfy Rule 12b-6, and therefore the case is exceptional. That we think that that's just wrong on the law. It's not a penalty for losing. That's in the case law everywhere from this court and others. But there was no proper finding that the case was objectively unreasonable or that there was an inadequate pre-suit investigation.
What about on the license aspect?
Yes, Your Honor. So the license aspect is something very important to the case. If we went to appendix page 749 and 750, this is what they produced as evidence of the license.
Just to be clear, this was a license you granted, so you should have had that license.
No, Your Honor. If you look at 749 to 750, appendix page.
I forget what's secret here, but this is a license from you to, you want to say it or should I?
It's NCR, but it's MCOM okay. to NCR.
So it's your license. How could you not have
it? NCR, we sued City National. We didn't sue NCR. We begged them to provide us anything with a license. We wrote to NCR to ask for it. NCR wouldn't communicate with us about whether they had a license with City National. You can go to appendix page 675 through 688.
I'm sorry. There would be two steps, right? You had a license with NCR, and then so you could presumably read it and figure out whether, for example, it provided a license to NCR's customers. Now, NCR, you would not have a customer list necessarily between the NCR, a list of NCR's customers to see if it included City National, but you would have the license.
Well, we did have the license. What we requested of City National was to contact NCR. We had done this with a couple of the defendants, had them send us a letter to say that they were licensed by NCR. No letter ever came. In fact, City National supposedly issued a subpoena to NCR, but no license was ever produced from it except for our license, MCOM's license with NCR.
There was no adjudication of whether or not there was a license, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We tried everything we could to work with the opposing side. We actually don't want to pursue lawsuits of someone's license because it wasted everyone's time. So we tried. But what they produced as an evidence of license is 749-750 is a redacted quote page that was never accepted. The terms were never accepted. So we don't even know that they purchased NCR. If you go to appendix page 675 through 688, that's the declaration of Perry Landers, one of our technical experts. He searched the code of the City National's bank on what was facing us and couldn't find NCR referenced anywhere, which is contrary to what normally happens when their NCR has a license purchase. So we went out of our way to try to prove that they had a license also, but we couldn't, and we asked them to produce one, and there was never adjudication on that.
Just to be clear about the terminology, when you say you asked them, that being City?
Yes, Your Honor.
City to produce a license. You don't mean the license that you provided to NCR. You mean the second stage, a license that NCR provided to City.
And even just limited, Your Honor, to a letter from NCR saying, hey, these people are our customers for the system that you accuse of infringing their license under this. And that never came. We begged them for that. Now I'm in my time. Unless the court has something more, I'd like to reserve the final.
Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Santucci.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Michael Santucci from 500 Law. I have Sal Fazio with me from my firm as well. We represent City National Bank of Florida.
So I have some real problems with the attorney's fees imposition here because I'm not sure that the record supports some of the grounds that the district court adopted for imposing attorney's fees. Let's take, for example, the efforts to coerce low-value settlements. I've looked at our cases on that. I just don't see the proof here that that was what was going on here. So help me on that. And again, with respect to the license, I mean, I don't understand how they're supposed to conduct an investigation of an affirmative defense. I mean, if they knew that the affirmative defense existed, that would be one thing. But I don't know why they're supposed to investigate an affirmative defense before bringing suit. Those are a couple of examples. There are other issues here also.
Okay.
So help me understand why some of these considerations weren't inappropriate.
Okay. I'll work backwards, Your Honor. With regard to the license, it was in a settlement agreement, yes, between NCR and...
We didn't even, sitting here today, we didn't even know whether there was a license or not to your client, right?
Well, the court in its...
No, answer the question. We don't know one way or the other whether it was a license for your client.
That's correct, Your Honor, because...
How can you impose sanctions for failing to investigate something where we don't even know what the investigation would have produced?
Because this is what the district court reasoned. It was brought up in the context of the attorney's fees motion. There was no finding on an affirmative defense of a license or settlement of a claim. That is absolutely true, Your Honor. But how this arose is we served a request to produce on MCOM, asked for documents which would have included such a settlement agreement or license. Nothing was produced. We served a subpoena duces tecum on our vendor, NCR, and they finally produced it. We learned that it was Mr. Ramey's firm that negotiated it.
How is it appropriate to sanction somebody for failing to investigate an affirmative defense when there's been no finding that such an investigation would have shown that the lawsuit was without merit?
I think in the report and recommendation, the magistrate judge was aware of the procedural history of the case and knew that this came from a subpoena duces tecum from our vendor, which...
I'm not hearing an answer to my question.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor. Then let me please have the opportunity.
How is it you can sanction somebody for not making an investigation when you don't know that the investigation would have shown that the lawsuit was meritless?
It wasn't what I think the court reasoned is that upon learning and receiving a copy of the document that was in his own files, they should have put the brakes on this case. And not then started making more settlement demands. They could have taken a voluntary dismissal without prejudice. They could have taken time to review this. Instead, we're meeting deadlines and spending money, meeting deadlines and spending money. The case went on for months more. So this was brought up in the context of the sanctions, not...
Let's turn to the coercive and low-value settlements. Where's the proof of that? They sued a lot of people. Where's the low-value settlements?
Yes. The court took the representations of the parties that there were low-value settlements, and the court looked at other cases in which...
Representations. What representations?
The representations of the parties in their briefs, but the courts did...
Where?
In the briefing below.
Where?
In the motion...
Representations. Where
yeah.
the did they represent that they coerced low-value settlements? I doubt it. Is that what you're saying?
They responded to our allegations.
Where's the proof?
Well, the actual settlement offers are not in the record, Your Honor. That is correct. But the court did look
at... They concede that they can worse low-value settlements?
What they said is they argued back that coercing or asking for low-value settlements is not in of itself bad faith. It's not in of itself sanctionable. But the district court did look to other cases of HSBC and of the firm that represents them as to their litigation tactics. It was brought up in that.
Where's the evidence that they got low-value settlements in these other cases?
There was a case cited in which I believe Mr. Ramey was sanctioned previously, and it was recited in that. It's not in the settlement offers are not in the record of our case. That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. So what I would like to do is answer a question I think of, it was Judge Taranto, which I believe, Judge Dyke, you also touched upon. This case is materially similar to the HSBC case in two respects. We also have this same common point of control problem in the pleading. We also have the problem of pleading an infringing system that the financial institution employs in a plausible way. Those two cases are the same, but we don't even have to get to that in our case because the first reason the court dismissed this complaint with prejudice, and the first time it struck it for this reason, is because the 11th Circuit despises shotgun pleadings. We have very tough case law in our 11th Circuit.
What's the definition of a shotgun pleading?
Okay, there are four that were set forth in the case law that we agree upon. I think this is a case from...
Don't need to tell me what the authority is. Okay. Tell me what it means.
Yes. The shotgun pleading in this case was this type of shotgun pleading. Oh.
You keep assuming that I know what the word shotgun in the phrase shotgun pleading means. That's what I'm asking you. I don't. Tell me what it means.
Understood. Okay. There are four... It means it's not specific.
The original problem was shotgun pleading because they were in a single count alleging direct infringement and induced infringement, things like that, right?
That is the type that is in our case.
Yeah, and they stripped that out of the amended complaint. So where's the shotgun pleading in the amended complaint?
Well, in the amended complaint, they pled three theories of liability, which they refer to as causes of action, direct infringement, indirect, contributory, and in one count. And in the 11th Circuit case law, that is that is not permitted. If you have different theories of liability, you must...
Did they separate them into different counts?
No, they did not. There were three paragraphs. They're separate paragraphs, but they're in the same single infringement count.
Where is this? Where in the record?
It is at... It's at page, can I have the amended complaint? It's in the infringement count, Your Honor. And it refers to various types of infringement in the one count. Oh, okay. Appendix 270 to 286, Your Honor. 270 to 286 is the first amended complaint.
Yeah, but where's the shotgun pleading aspect?
In the specific count section.
It's only one count, is that right?
Correct.
That runs from 271 to 284?
Correct. And there are references to three distinct theories of liability in that one count.
Okay, and you're saying that putting it in a single count, even if they're separated into separate theories of liability, not in the same paragraphs of the complaint, that's a shotgun pleading?
Under 11th Circuit law, yes. And the procedure...
The case tells us that.
Okay. That is... one case is Vibe Micro Inc. versus Chabanets at 878 Fed 3rd, 1291. It's an 11th Circuit case, and it says that the court must first, which it did, sua sponte, give one chance to replead in a way that does not constitute a shotgun pleading. After that opportunity, if the party still neither filed a complaint pleading it...
Just to be clear, I don't think... the question was about how many opportunities. The question, the question I'm interested in an answer to is, what case law says that this kind of single count that within it clearly delineates several different highly related wrongs, but clearly delineates them, would constitute an impermissible so-called shotgun pleading?
There's more than one case that were cited, Your Honor, by us. It's the Vibe Micro case is one of them. And the other sites. And the other's right at page, the other is right at page 1 and 2 of the, of MCOM's reply, where it discusses the four different types of pleadings the 11th Circuit calls shotgun pleadings, which includes that, a description of that kind, where
What case says putting them under a single count is impermissible if they're separated into different paragraphs with distinct theories?
Thank you. Your Honor, it's the Wayland case, Wayland versus Palm Beach City Sheriff's Office, 792 Fed 3rd, 1313, 11th Circuit. And it defines four different categories of shotgun pleadings, the third of which is complaints that fail to separate each cause of action into a different count. And that was cited by MCOM in their reply, page 1 and 2.
What would be the harm that would flow from that?
Because different theories of infringement require different factual allegations to support them. One might require knowledge, one does not. And this case law applies obviously not just to patent law, but in our case, that's why it would make a difference.
This seems to be saying that the deficiency is not labeling them separate counts, as opposed to not separating them into discrete paragraphs of the complaint, which they did.
Right. The sin here is not...
not labeling them separate counts.
Correct. Not separating them into separate counts with separate facts supporting each different theory of liability. And the district court gave them one opportunity. They did the same thing the second time. And they were warned under threat of sanction if they were to fail to comply with the order striking. And that was one of the bases for the sanctions order under 1927. So
if some of the bases cited by the district court for finding the case exceptional, if we were to conclude that the ones that we've talked about are unsupported, what would we do?
I think there's enough overlap. I don't know. Sometimes it's been referred to 6 different reasons. Some called it 8 different reasons in this case. There was plenty of support for each award. So I don't think anyone
demand to have the district court reconsider the attorney's fees question, sanctions question.
We're asking that
if the district court relied on impermissible grounds, we can't just affirm, right?
Well, Your Honor, you can, because there are other reasons. There's a variety of reasons that the court
did. Did the district court say that these were independent reasons for awarding sanctions?
The court looked at it in the totality of the circumstances.
Oh, okay, so if part of the circumstances were not right,
yes,
we have to send it back to have him reconsider the totality of the circumstances using the right circumstances?
Well, certainly not.
Yes or no?
No, as to 1927, as to 285, as to the award of fees under exceptional, I would also say no, because there's enough there. Even if the court ignores whether or not there was the license applied to our client or not, even if the court ignores the pre-suit investigation. There was an admission at the fee hearing by counsel of record for MCOM that she did fail to independently investigate this case and relied completely upon Mr. Ramey, who was not of record and not admitted in the case, but was acting in a lead counsel capacity. The report and recommendation makes it very clear that that was somewhat shocking to the court, that the attorney below would
What's the basis for your, I think you answered Judge Dyke's question by saying, first, 1927 is one thing, 285 is another, 285 has this totality of the circumstances. What's the basis for your separating out 1927 in this case? What's the basis? If we were to conclude that the 285 exceptional case determination had to be vacated and with a remand for reconsideration?
Because in the order adopting the report and recommendation on that part of it, the court stated that these factors...
Okay, where are you reading from?
It is appendix... First of all, the order is appendix 1 through 4.
That's the district court's own order rejecting the objections to the report and recommendation.
Yes, Your Honor. And adopting the report and recommendation. So it is at the bottom of Appendix 3, where the court said this caused vexation and unnecessary litigation, thus warranting 1927 sanctions. The analysis seems in this section that the court believed that each one of these alleged violations that it mentions was itself sanctionable, and well, the court limited.
This paragraph talks about, at least in part, failing to investigate whether the MCOM license to NCR carried forward to your client. And I thought earlier in the argument you stated in response to Judge Dyke's question that we still do not know whether your client in fact had coverage from NCR. So how could one possibly say the failure to investigate that caused unnecessary litigation with reference to the license?
I respectfully disagree with the premise of your question, Your Honor, and here's why. At this time, the court was operating, and it was Your Honor who asked Mr. Ramey to clarify today as to whether he's arguing that there is no license, because that is what it sounds like throughout this whole case, or whether or not there was a license, and the real issue is whether or not it applies to our client, City National Bank. He just clarified that here, but that is not evident from his arguments. So at the hearing on the sanctions, the court finally ordered us to file under seal this confidential settlement and license agreement, because up until that time...
Between MCOM and NCR?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so I think what's underlying a lot of this...
Sir, and is your invocation of that his client gave NCR a license to practice the patent when they sold you something, then even without anything but a sale under exhaustion doctrine, you're free and clear?
No, it's because of the specific release language in the settlement agreement that it applies to NCR's customers.
Okay, but it was not proven, or this is part of what I'm confused about. Is there still an unadjudicated question whether your client was a customer subject to that language in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, because we never got that before. Yes.
Oh, well that.
Yes, it is unadjudicated. You are correct, because we never got that far. But the court was operating under the question, was trying to determine the question of whether there was even a license, because it wasn't part of the record, because we respected the confidentiality of the document. And then it took us all the way to the hearing on the sanctions before the court said, okay, go ahead and file it under seal. All along, MCOM is arguing that there is no license, which is somewhat, it required clarification, let's just say that, of Judge Taranto at that point. But each one of these, back to my point, each one of these grounds was itself worthy of sanction, and the court did limit its award to only those fees that were incurred from the first amended complaint forward to the dismissal. And I am out of time, Your Honor, so if there are no more questions.
Okay, thank you.
We're asking for for the court to affirm both orders, the order of dismissal and the order of fees and sanctions.
Okay, Mr. Ramey.
2 minutes, Your Honor. Thank you. Briefly to address, if I might, the shotgun pleading issue. If you go to appendix page 271 and 272, we don't put in one count. We, in fact, have a section titled infringement of the 508 patent. Then we list in separate paragraphs the allegations for direct infringement. That's appendix 271, 272. Induced infringement, appendix 273, separate paragraph, so different facts. And then contributory infringement, 273 to 274. Again, different facts. We don't rely on facts from a previous part of the pleading. So we do think we didn't do a shotgun pleading, even under 11th Circuit standards in this one, but definitely not under Rule 8 and what this court requires for pleading standards. Lastly, wanted to, if I might, Your Honor, spend a little bit of time on my local counsel on the Section 1927, then that they must fail as a matter of law. Because the R&R doesn't satisfy the three required elements. There's no unreasonable and vexatious conduct that's established by the report and recommendation, nor by the district court's adoption of that order. There's no multiplication of the proceedings. As we've talked about in great detail, we tried to get to the bottom of what the district court appeared, the license issue, whether or not there was a license that would, in fact, inure to NCR's benefit. We went out of our way, and we're always open to it. And then there's no casual link to the excess cost. There's the First Amendment complaint doesn't automatically delineate when something became unreasonable, and there was no finding by the district court that's when it became unreasonable. What the record actually shows, Your Honors, is a single complaint. Then the judge given us permission to file an amended complaint, instructing us of what he wanted to see differently. We went back, we substantially modified that complaint, tried to address everything the district court brought up, and as we're dismissing the case, then presented a First Amendment complaint.
Does the Whalen case that your friend on the other side cited from page 2 of your gray brief say, as I think he says, it says that what's required is putting different causes of action into separate counts, not just into separate paragraphs?
What it says is you can't file and have within the same count rely back on evidence from the previous one. So here we didn't do that. You can't incorporate by reference. Pardon me, I was having a slight issue. But you can't incorporate by reference preceding information from other paragraphs. And we specifically didn't do that here. I'm looking at the case right now. It was my quick read. This is one we cited back in our responsive briefing as well. But what it's saying is you can't try to incorporate by reference preceding paragraphs. That's what's making it shotgun pleading in essence. And then there are four listed. But here we went out of our way to put each of ours in separate counts, if you would. They're just separate paragraphs, not delineated as counts. We don't delineate any particular paragraph as a count. More fundamentally, I'm out of time, but if I could get to spend just 3 more seconds. There was no bad faith alleged that would be subject to 1927, and the report and recommendation didn't find it. So we'd ask that this court either allow the case to go to trial, finding the complaint sufficient, or allow us the chance to amend, because we did a good faith amendment, or to vacate the sanctions under 285 and the sanctions under 1927, and if there are any under the inherent power of the court, we'd ask the court to reverse those. Okay. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.